Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
If you have kids, you know it's hard to get them to eat right. Heck, it's hard for adults to eat fresh fruits and vegetables with every meal.
I love burgers and fries, yeah, and I love ice cream and cake, and so do most kids. And we're not talking about a lifestyle that excludes all that. The question is, how do we help people balance that out?
Maybe what the First Lady needs is a chorus of singing vegetables straight out of the Muppet Show.
And now, presenting my singing food!
We have an old-fashioned tomato.
Between overhauling healthcare and getting kids to eat broccoli, I kind of think the first task is the easier one.
Oh, I love my vegetables! How are you, cabbage?
Oh, getting ahead.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 9th, and the takeaway for me, John, is, you know, he thinks it's hard to tangle with the Republicans over health care. Wait till he tries to separate kids from their Lucky Charms.
Well, I think you're right. Vegetables do need a powerful lobbying organization, and the Muppets are definitely it there. I think that's some serious sway. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. After talking about it for days, it's official. Toyota is recalling over 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. Toyota President Akio Toyoda says the company is committed to fixing the braking systems on models that went on sale last year.
We will do everything in our power to regain the confidence of our customers.
More than 130,000 customers, Prius hybrids, and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids are part of today's U.S. recall. And if you're counting, that means Toyota's recall is now close to 9 million vehicles worldwide.
Tributes are being paid this morning to John Murtha, the first Vietnam combat veteran to serve in Congress. He died yesterday following complications from gallbladder surgery. Murtha was 77 years old. He represented a district in southwestern Pennsylvania known for its steel mills and coal mines. He wielded considerable clout for two decades as the ranking Democrat on the committee that oversees Pentagon spending. Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell says it's a big loss for the state.
He was our go-to guy, someone that whatever the issue was, could weigh in and make things happen for us.
Murtha spent 36 years in Congress.
Iran is saying that it has begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%, far short of the weapons grade 90% needed for nuclear bombs, but still increases fears, and Western nations are calling for sanctions.
And just last hour, First Lady Michelle Obama launched a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity. She tells ABC News it'll encourage more physical activity for kids, healthier foods in schools, and more accurate food labeling.
This is going to require an effort on everyone's part.
You can say that again. We're joined now by Tony Gerasi. He's the food service director for Baltimore City Schools. Tony, good morning.
Good morning.
How many kids do you serve every day?
83,000 plus hungry kids.
Okay, so, I mean, cafeteria food, not knowing for being all that delicious. So what's the best healthy entree you serve to kids?
Well, it's going to come off of our Meatless Monday menus. We do a baked lasagna served with like a romaine lettuce salad and fresh fruit, or the baked eggplant parmesan also served with like steamed vegetables and fresh fruit.
It sounds good to me. I don't know if it would sound good to my 11-year-old. We're going to talk more to Joni Gerasi in just a moment. But we're asking you to weigh in on this. If you've ever gone on a diet, you know it's pretty hard. We want to get your personal take. What are your tips for losing weight?
This is Megan from Massachusetts. I lost some weight, and the way I did it was I made small, healthy choices, and I never really sacrificed anything. If I wanted it, I had it. But I'd wait. If I wanted pizza, wait 2 days and then eat it.
Give us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE or post on our website, thetakeaway.org. Looking at the markets, futures are up. The Dow will start at 9,908. The S&P opens at 1,056 and the NASDAQ at 2,126.
In honor of upcoming Valentine's Day, love in the workplace. Beth Koblenner's on the case. And more on Michelle Obama and childhood obesity in just a few minutes.
Okay, we all know Americans are fat. Two-thirds of U.S. adults and nearly one in three children are overweight or obese, increasing the risk for diabetes, heart disease, and other chronic illnesses. So the White House is now taking on junk food. Today, the First Lady unveils Let's Move, an administration-wide campaign to fight childhood obesity. Here's Michelle Obama on Good Morning America just about an hour ago.
We want to improve the quality of food in our schools, and we want to make food more affordable and accessible because we have food deserts for more than 23.5 million Americans, folks who don't live anywhere near a supermarket, so they can't get access to good, fresh produce.
Joining us now, the Arkansas Surgeon General and practicing pediatrician Joe Thompson. He's the director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center to Prevent Childhood Obesity. And Tony Geraci is the food service director for Baltimore City Schools. He's trying to introduce some better eating habits on a very tight budget. Welcome to both of you. And good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
And Tony Geraci joins us again. He's the food service director for Baltimore City Schools. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Thompson, we've been hearing these reports for years. It hasn't seemed to alarm anyone over much, parents anyway, and we haven't seen childhood obesity reducing, going down, I should say. And yet you have some amazing statistics, and you've actually have reports from people who are saying that childhood obesity is a threat to our national security. What makes this such an important issue?
Well, I think this decade we have recognized how much our children have gained weight over the last three decades, and we're starting now to see the impact of adult diseases in earlier and earlier ages. It really represents a threat not only to the future well-being of our families and communities, but also of our workforce, and that's why it has become such a critical issue.
Well, there's there's a number of different causes for why a child could be overweight. I mean, it could be a huge number of things, but it's most likely not genetics.
That's absolutely correct. We've seen this epidemic blossom over the last three decades, and your genes don't change that quickly. It really is basically because our kids are eating far more calories than they need, and they're not burning off as many by being physically active.
Tony Geraci, you serve, as you said, 85,000 students or so per day in the Baltimore City Schools?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's more than 200 schools that you cater to.
Correct.
So you bring these kids in. I'm sure a lot of them aren't happy that they're eating in the cafeteria anyway. How do you get them to eat something healthy? I mean, how do you get 85,000 kids to eat eggplant parmesan?
Well, look, the population that I serve are largely underprivileged, and the meals that they get at school are probably the only real meals that they're going to get every day that are consistent. So what we try to do is we try to offer up better choices for our kids. One in three kids born after the year 2000 are going to get type 2 diabetes, and one in two African-American kids are going to get this disease. And the good doctor is right. This is going to devastate our country in the next 20 years.
Dr. Thompson, you come from Arkansas. Arkansas, I think, is number two on the states that are most overweight. How have you dealt with this in your own state as Surgeon General there?
Well, I think we, like other southern states, and as your other guest mentioned, lower-income communities have an extra added risk from the obesity. We've really taken an approach to try to change the environment that kids live, learn, and play every day, trying to improve the cafeteria offerings in the school, trying to increase the level of activities both within the school and changing the environment around the school so that kids can walk and bike again. And we're raising awareness so that parents actually recognize the risk and can take some simple steps that over time will make a lasting change.
Okay, but parents themselves have trouble losing weight, and I imagine they would then have trouble getting their kids to. And, you know, you also, Mike Huckabee, quite famously tried to, as a politician, set an example, as a politician set policy that would help change people's healthy eating habits, and that didn't exactly work. How do you do that as a policymaker?
Well, I think it will take the actions of all policymakers. We have continued many of the programs and are trying to expand those now under a Democratic governor, and we're seeing a halting of the obesity epidemic. But we've got to have change at the federal and the local levels working in concert if we're going to be able to reverse this epidemic.
So, Tony Geraci, do you have kids?
Yeah, I have three kids, in fact.
Okay, so if you, as you said, if these kids are coming to school and it's one of their only meals, that's not a solution for their entire eating habits. What do you think is your one piece of advice in order for parents to deal with childhood obesity?
Well, I think to try to get better choices in front of their kids. Our kids today live in this world of portion distortion. They've been supersized for so many years and so many generations now that kids don't even understand what a real portion is. I had a group of high school kids in my office a couple of weeks ago talking about wanting more food I think education is the key. I think we've got to sit down and start having real conversations about food.
Okay, Dr. Thompson, what's the one piece of advice you could maybe give to First Lady Michelle Obama that would actually work?
Well, I would ask her and more importantly, everyone across the nation to really challenge to become much more aware of your environment. I mean, employers need to look at what's in the vending machines, the opportunity for us to see where grocery stores are not so that families could actually have access to healthier foods. These are all things that we can take on with policy change to make the healthy choice become the easy choice.
Well, it's not exactly easy to change an entire family's eating habits. And Tony Geraci, if you're handling the kids because they're a captive audience in your cafeteria, do you ever reach out to parents and try to change what they're doing at home?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a lot of parent engagement, and we're working with parents now around healthier choices and trying to create opportunity for fresh food in neighborhoods that, quite honestly, are food deserts.
And the answer to those who say it's too expensive to eat healthily, Tony Geraci actually serves meals for about $2.75 per kid, so I guess it is affordable. Tony Geraci, food service director for the Baltimore City Schools. He serves about 85,000 kids every day. And Dr. Joseph Thompson is Surgeon General for Arkansas and founder of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center to Prevent Childhood Obesity. And we're asking you today, in this push to get Americans to eat more healthily, especially our kids, what are your tips for eating right and losing weight? Or what are your personal vices? Do you have something which is just causes you to eat badly every single time you see it? Maybe
our
listener
curator Leo wants you to confess your vices. He that's his thing. Okay, if you don't want to confess your vices,
8778 my take or my take at thetakeaway.org. And now let's check in on the top stories at 15 minutes after the hour.
Toyota says it will recall more than 130,000 Prius cars and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids in the U.S., part of a worldwide recall to fix brake problems. Toyota's president says his company is, quote, not an infallible company that never makes mistakes. Iran says it has begun a new program of enriching its uranium to a higher grade of 20%. That's far below weapons grade. Project began despite objections from the international community. And yesterday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said the United Nations should impose sanctions on Iran in, quote, weeks, not months.
In Connecticut, authorities have opened a criminal investigation into the cause of an explosion at a power plant on Sunday. Middletown Police Chief Patrick McMahon says officials have a warrant to investigate the site.
Although intentional criminal acts have been ruled out, we have not ruled out criminal acts of negligence. And therefore, until that search warrant has expired, it is a crime scene and is treated as such.
The explosion killed 5 people. Weather news now. Just as the Mid-Atlantic region digs out from the blizzard over the weekend, the area is expecting another big storm. The nation's capital may be in for another foot of snow or more. And finally, for fans in New Orleans, the Super Bowl victory party continues today as the Saints are honored with a parade this afternoon, beginning at their home turf, the Louisiana Superdome. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're looking ahead all this week to the 2010 Winter Olympics.
I'm hoping that people feel like they're part of the skating world again, and we haven't had that in the United States since Nancy and Tanya.
Well, the answer to Nancy and Tanya, Johnny Weir, and complete with swan skating costumes. We're going to have a profile of him in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout this morning is an obituary and also a discussion of a coming changing of the guard in the Congress, the House, and the Senate. Congressman John P. Murtha from the 12th District of Pennsylvania died yesterday at the age of 77 after suffering complications from gallbladder surgery. He made headlines shortly after the onset of the Iraq War, really in the mid-2000s, when he called for the war to end, that the future of our country cannot sustain the Iraq War, and he spoke publicly about it.
Our military is suffering. The future of our country is at risk. We cannot continue on the present course. It is evident that continued military action in Iraq is not in the best interest of the United States of America.
John Murtha, who died in complications from a gallbladder surgery yesterday. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick has covered Congressman Murtha for all the time you've been on Capitol Hill. Here was somebody from the Vietnam generation who had a long rise and then a difficult sort of end game.
Yeah, that's right, John. Jack Murtha, a 19-term congressman and former Marine colonel. And one of the old guard of the Vietnam era, as you mentioned, there are still plenty of Vietnam vets left in Congress, but Murtha was one of the most influential. I want to paint a picture for you quickly of the House chamber, just to give you a sense of how Murtha operated. He was famous for it around Congress. There's no assigned seating in the House of Representatives. Members sit wherever they want. But in the back corner, in the back row on the right-hand side, there's a little area that's informally known as the Pennsylvania Corner. Huh. And that's where members from Pennsylvania go to chat. It's just an informal place. And this area is known because Jack Murtha was always found there. If you wanted to find Jack Murtha during any given vote, you look in the back row in the corner, and there was Murtha holding court. Members gathered around him, sometimes passing notes, coming for advice, coming for discussions from both sides of the aisle. And they did it for a couple of reasons. One, 19 terms. The guy knew where the bones were buried. He was a very senior member. But also, as a senior appropriator, he controlled all of the spending at the Defense Department, not to mention all those thousands and thousands of earmarks. And that's how Jack Murtha did business. He controlled so much of the pet money that members needed to bring back to those bases in their districts. And they came to see Murtha because, as everyone knew in Congress, Jack Murtha gaveth and Jack Murtha tooketh away. Everyone knew it, and that's why they came to see him in the Pennsylvania corner.
But ironically, it was Murtha's proximity to that Pentagon largesse that was in some sense his undoing. He could have been majority leader, but it didn't make it.
He came very close. When Nancy Pelosi reached the speakership after being House Minority Leader for so many years, she backed Jack Murtha to be Majority Leader. He lost. And you're right, John. Part of the reason he did was his proximity to earmarking some scandals that have affected a lot of lobbying firms. Now, we have to stress that Jack Murtha was never convicted of any crimes or even charged. I got to take you back to the Belushi era of Saturday Night Live, almost 1980, the abscam, FBI sting, where several members of Congress took bribe money from who they thought was a corrupt Arab sheik, a Saudi sheik. Turns out it was an FBI informant in a beard. Jack Murtha never took a bribe, but he was in the room, and he was never charged, but he was implicated.
You know, it occurred to me yesterday that this Vietnam generation in the House and the Senate, it has an interesting legacy. I mean, you've got Murtha, you've got Kerry, a combat veteran. John Kerry, Bob Kerry, combat veteran. Right. You got John McCain, combat veteran. But both Kerry and McCain also ran for the president. Ironically, the draft dodgers, Clinton and George W. Bush, who was in the National Guard, got it to the White House. The combat veterans didn't make it. Cheney got 5 deferments and made it to be one of the most powerful vice presidents in U.S. history. What is the legacy here?
Well, look at Randy Duke Cunningham, a famous Vietnam ace pilot, powerful member of Congress who went to jail for corruption just a couple of years ago. It's an interesting way to look at it, John. Jack Murtha, again, a Marine colonel. He was the first Vietnam veteran elected to Congress, and some of the Iraq veterans and newer veterans who are getting elected now look to him as a mentor, people like Patrick Murphy of Pennsylvania, who is an Iraq veteran. You're right that a lot of the combat veterans never made it to the very top. Murtha himself, as you said, almost reached majority leader, but not quite, but he wielded enormous power in the House. He wielded the kind of power you don't see, the behind-the-scenes money power.
And McCain still does, we should say. Todd Zwillick, a Takeaway Washington correspondent, talking about a coming changing of the guard there with the passing of John Murtha.
And now to our sports takeout with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. The Super Bowl is over and we're moving on to the 2010 Olympic Games. And we have a profile today of someone who, if nothing else, he sparks a discussion around his sport. That's figure skater Johnny Weir. Ibrahim, Johnny Weir is known for his outlandish costumes. Not only that, but what he says, he's kind of outspoken in what he says. That's how he's become sort of a focus of media attention.
Well, just to get a sense of who Johnny Weir is, he's the ultimate commenter on the ice and in defending his sport. Listen to what he had to say to ESPN's Jim Capel.
That's why people don't necessarily think it's a real sport, is because it looks easy. We're not out there tackling or being tackled or checked or running excessively. It looks effortless and beautiful and graceful and all these things, but you know, I would challenge any football player or baseball player, well, especially baseball players. I mean, how you can be 300 pounds and play a sport and get paid millions of dollars to do it, I'll never know.
So Johnny Weir is a three-time national champion, and he's a former world bronze medalist, but he hasn't won gold at the Olympics, and that's what this Olympics is about for Johnny Weir, to prove that.
Well, he missed his bus, famously, didn't he? When he was supposed to skate, he went out to go catch the bus, and the bus schedule had changed, and he didn't know it, and he didn't make it on time.
And for those moments, he gets an incredible amount of attention. In 2007, the movie Blades of Glory was built around his life.
That's right.
He's got a show on the Sundance.
Not flattering.
Yeah. And he's got a show on the Sundance Channel, but I think what's important about him is that he challenges the gender binary. He kind of pushes the boundaries. You don't really know which way he's coming from, but you have to acknowledge that he's an incredibly gifted athlete.
At the
age of 12, he did an axel on his first week on skates, and his coach is like, "How did you learn how to do that?" And he said, "I just watched it on TV." So if anything about Johnny Weir is that he is incredibly gifted, and he is definitely a person to watch.
And he is a fierce competitor,
indeed,
as you said. Thanks so much, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our Takeaway sports contributor. Coming up, we're going to be talking about what the president wants to do to get some agreement on health care.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, new strategy and tactics by the Obama administration on health care reform. We'll talk with David Herzenhorn of The New York Times in just a moment. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Bad news continues for Toyota, but they just made it official this morning. The company recalling 130,000 Prius hybrids and nearly 15,000 Lexus hybrids sold here in the United States last year. It's part of the latest recall of over 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide. Toyota President Akio Toyoda says he may come to the U.S. next week to explain the massive recalls, which cover nearly 9 million cars total.
Let me assure everyone that we will redouble our commitment to quality as a lifeline of our company, with myself taking the lead.
He'll be dealing with economic ripples from all the recalls. This morning, the Washington Post reports that State Farm, the nation's largest auto insurer, warned federal regulators about problems with Toyotas as far back as 2007. Iran says it's begun enriching uranium to a higher grade of 20%, far short of the weapons grade 90%. But Defense Secretary Robert Gates says it wants the UN Security Council to approve a resolution in weeks, not months, that would impose new sanctions against Iran.
If Iran continues and develops nuclear weapons, it almost certainly will provoke nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. This is a huge danger.
China, though, remains opposed to sanctions, and they do have veto power. In Afghanistan, there are reports that the Taliban is preventing people from fleeing a city that's the target of a NATO offensive. Witnesses in Marja say families are huddling inside their homes to avoid being caught in the crossfire. A quick check of the markets. The Dow will start at 9,908, and the S&P opens at 1,056, the NASDAQ at 2,126. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So the future of health care reform on Capitol Hill, well, the president has a plan. And on the one hand, it sounds completely reasonable, inviting congressional leaders from both parties to the White House to get people together to attempt to find some sort of common ground. Here he is speaking about what his intentions are, talking to the Democratic National Committee fundraiser in Washington last Thursday.
What I'd like to do is have a meeting whereby I'm sitting with the Republicans, sitting with the Democrats, sitting with health care experts. And let's just go through these bills, their ideas, our ideas. Let's walk through them in a methodical way so that the American people can see and compare what makes the most sense.
We do have a name for that. It's called Congress and the White House. That's what they're supposed to be doing. But, of course, the failures on health care reform motivated the president to do something with cameras rolling. Is it a high-stakes game, or is it utterly reasonable and really the only way to move forward on health care reform right now? We've asked David Herzenhorn, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, to join us. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Haven't talked to you for a while. You know, this seems to me to be both kind of standard issue Obama, but also certainly a departure from relying on Congress to actually deliver a bill. Which is it?
Well, look, you know, right now they don't have the votes in Congress. So if you want to pass a bill, you better do something. And the president is trying to send messages to a lot of folks, to lawmakers, to voters, that he's not giving up on this. And yet, as you point out, you know, there's one place where the debate matters, and that's on the floor of each chamber in
Congress, and in the Senate, the Democrats have a problem. They can't get past a Republican filibuster.
Now, let me push back a little bit on this, and you can throw water all over me if you like. What is the chance that this will actually produce a compromise bill versus just making a lot of campaign videos for Republicans who will be seen standing up to the president who's trying to force something down the Americans' throats?
Well, you know, look, this could go both ways, right? I mean, the president might be creating a situation where he offers some political cover to Democrats to do what they need to do to move, you know, a bill in expedited fashion through the Senate under a budget reconciliation process that would need only 51 votes. Remember, 51 votes is still a majority of the Senate as opposed to the filibuster, which takes 40 votes to stop it. So, you know, both sides are jockeying for position here. The chance of a bipartisan compromise bill, there seems to be very little of that. Colleague Robert Perrin and I wrote about the Republican ideas in the newspaper this morning, and you should see the hate mail that's coming in from Democratic-leaning readers.
Well,
don't even want to read about those ideas. Yeah.
Well, you know, the question of where the GOP is on having a sort of theoretical health care reform bill of its own is really sort of all over the map. Here's Lamar Alexander on the floor last month responding to a rhetorical question he sort of assumes Democrats are asking, which is, what are Republicans waiting for here? Listen.
They'll be waiting a long time for the answer to that. If they're waiting for the Republican leader, Senator McConnell, to roll into the Senate a wheelbarrow filled with a 2,700-page Republican comprehensive health care bill.
Now, David Hertzenhorn of The New York Times, it seems as though Lamar Alexander is suggesting there that there is no policy behind the GOP, that it's really just a tactic. Do you agree with that?
Well, they've taken a careful approach here, right? The Democrats are in the majority. The Democrats set the agenda, and their point, the Republican leader Mitch McConnell as well, has said, look, we don't want to do a big, comprehensive, you know, system-wide overhaul. They want to go more of a step-by-step approach. Now, there are experts who will say that that won't get you where you need to go. That won't control health care costs. It won't cover the tens of millions of people who are uninsured. On the other hand, there's a lot of apprehension, as we've seen in polls, among Americans about so much change so fast.
And it does seem as though Congress is willing to, you know, where you need to go is simply get some doable bill out of the House and Senate. If they do something that is, in theory, doable here, what are we likely to see? What is doable? What sort of compromise could actually produce some kind of health care change?
Well, you know, the two sides certainly agree on some small things, like extending dependent coverage for adult children who get out of college. They're not in the job market necessarily yet, or in a job market where they have benefits. So, you know, allowing adult children to stay on their parents' policies till age 25 or 26 is something both sides agree on. In theory, they both agree on trying to figure out a way to stop insurance companies from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions. The Republicans, however, are finding it hard to get that into a limited proposal. Obviously, if you want to cover everybody, you need to have healthy people in the risk pool along with sick people, or it's just not affordable. So, you know, there are bits and pieces where they agree in theory of selling insurance across state lines, something that Republicans have long called for. The Democrats say they want to do the same thing. The question is, do you tighten federal regulation so that insurance companies just don't pick the state with the weakest regulations to be the one where they write their policies with the minimum levels of coverage? So that, you know, they're even on in areas where they agree, like something like, you know, selling insurance across state lines, they go about it in very different ways.
David Hertzenhorn, congressional correspondent for The New York Times, talking about new tactics and that new approach to health care reform by the Obama administration, going public, convening a summit, and trying to talk about where the common ground is with the cameras rolling. Thank you, David.
Speaking of health care, here's a new approach to health care. How about we reduce health care costs by getting people to reduce their weight? The First Lady is taking on childhood obesity, and we want to open it up to you. If you've lost weight, do you have any tips for everyone else?
This is Laurie from Nashville. I'm a visual person, so what helps me is to make a chart, and I will write down what I've eaten for the day. And at the end of the day, sometimes I'm surprised because I didn't even know that that's what I was putting in my mouth.
Tell us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we talk about work on Tuesday and today.
Grab a cup of coffee and squint across the table. Oh, my God, it's the Corporate Clark Gable. Office Romance, makes the day go faster. Office Romance.
In case you didn't know, Valentine's Day is coming, and we're wondering about office romances. Can they make you work better? We're going to talk more about it later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. Iran has announced it's enhancing and expanding its nuclear program. The United States and France responded, saying there's no alternative now but strong new international sanctions against Iran. And the U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says Iran has rejected Western overtures and a collective international will is needed to find a peaceful way to resolve the issue. We're joined earlier by the BBC's John Lyon. He's our reporter in the field on Iran, and he filled us in on the latest from that country.
Well, they're stepping up enrichment from the level which you need to make fuel for a normal nuclear plant, 3.5 to 5%, which you can't use to make weapons, up to 20%, which you still can't use to make weapons, but it gets closer and it's much quicker. If you had a 5% uranium in a stockpile, which Iran does, it would take a couple of years to turn that into weapons grade. That is, with all the ifs and buts, and you kick out all the inspectors and you create that fast. But in theory, in a couple of years, they could produce a bomb.
So what
now,
is it?
If they then have a stockpile of 20%, they could then, from that material, make a bomb in maybe as little as 6 months. So it makes it a very dangerous situation.
So what does Iran say that their purpose is?
Well, they're talking about providing fuel for a Tehran research reactor, which they say produces much-needed medical isotopes. I think the rest of the world is pretty sceptical and really thinks this is more of a bluster, really, because most experts think it would be very difficult for Iran, although it may be able to produce the 20% fuel, it won't be able to turn it into workable fuel rods, which would actually be useful in that plant.
Hey, this is the Defense Secretary Robert Gates speaking from France.
The key is persuading the Iranian leaders that their long-term best interests are best served by not having nuclear weapons.
How does one do that? How does one convince the Iranian government that they are best served by not having nuclear technology?
Well, the point is to convince them that to have a program, I think, that is clearly civilian and has enough guarantees, because the outside world insists that they don't have a problem with Iran having civilian technology, but they want more guarantees. The problem at the moment is that the Iranian government is not very susceptible to outside pressure. The real pressure on President Ahmadinejad is coming domestically from the opposition, who are going out in the streets again on Thursday, particularly from hardliners in his inner circle. So if he gives any sign of compromise, he just gets more trouble. So at the moment, it's really not worth his while compromising, even if he faces tough new sanctions.
Well, what kind of tough new sanctions would he be facing? What else do they have to threaten him with?
Well, there's some proposals going around the United Nations, particularly some interesting financial sanctions, including sanctions on the Iranian Central Bank, which, if they'd gotten through the UN, could be quite tough, but they got the problem of convincing China, and that is a big problem at the moment.
Who could veto any sanctions that they want to put forward, any at all?
That's right. They could veto or they could water the sanctions down to make them almost meaningless.
That's John Lyon. He was the BBC's Iran reporter. He joined us earlier from London.
All this morning, we're following the First Lady's fight, which she inaugurated today, against childhood obesity. But as anyone who's ever gone on a diet has told you, it's harder than it sounds. I mean, it seems like there are so many cultural messages about weight loss, it would be impossible for kids to miss. But we want to make it personal, not just for kids, for everyone. What's the reason that you've lost weight, and what's a tip that actually has worked for you? David in Southfield, Michigan emails us, turn down the thermostat, save money, help the environment, burn extra calories without thinking about it. I wonder if he has any data on that method. Tell us your stories, tips, and diet sins at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it all to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, are you attracted to someone at work? Maybe you want to go out for a date. You're thinking about it, but you're afraid there may be negative repercussions. Well, the good news is that actually there aren't a huge number of companies that forbid dating on the job. And also, dating somebody at your workplace can actually make you more productive. We're going to talk about this in just a few moments. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. First Lady Michelle Obama is launching Let's Move, a nationwide campaign to fight childhood obesity. This morning, she told ABC what she envisions for young Americans.
They're enjoying their food, they're eating their vegetables, they're doing their running and walking and playing, and still, you know, have time to get a good fun meal in every once in a while. That's the life that, you know, I'm hoping that we can build for Americans.
To do that, the First Lady wants healthier foods, also more physical activity for kids, and better food labeling. So we've been talking about this all morning, and we want your take on this. If you've lost weight, what is the tip you have for everybody else? And part of the reason people have trouble losing weight is because their particular vices, maybe it's chocolate. We want to know what yours is. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. Democratic Congressman John Murtha of Pennsylvania is being remembered on Capitol Hill today for being a leading veteran advocate. Yesterday, Murtha died of complications from gallbladder surgery. He was 77.
We've been reporting all morning that Toyota is recalling more than 400,000 Prius and other hybrid cars worldwide to fix widely reported brake problems. But could the latest recall get even bigger? We're joined now by Paul Eisenstein, a reporter for the DetroitBureau.com. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, John.
So it seems that, you know, we've kind of opened a can of worms here, and all of a sudden there are a lot of reports emerging. I'm wondering if you're seeing a broader pattern than just the 2010 Toyota hybrids.
Yeah, the DetroitBureau.com is reporting that there's a significant number of complaints, both with National Highway Traffic Safety Administration investigators, and we have been receiving a flood of complaints that date back as far as the 2005 Prius that indicate that there are various braking problems, alleged braking problems, we'll say right now, but some of them clearly match the problems on the 2010 models, the only ones that Toyota plans to recall at this moment.
How do you determine a real engineering problem from something that's basically a result of all the media attention where somebody goes, hey, you know what? My car was doing this weird thing. I'll call the 800 number. You know what I mean?
That's a very, very serious issue, and that's one of the reasons why we were particularly interested when we started getting problems about emails about problems with the Prius before all the latest headlines where Toyota has acknowledged and now plans to repair a braking issue with the 2010. But this ultimately will be up to Toyota and federal investigators here and Japanese investigators. But we do believe, based on our evidence, both in government files and what we're hearing directly, that a further investigation is necessary, and if it proves that there are problems, we could see this recall expand beyond the 2010 model year.
Well, we'll keep watching, and we will stay in touch with Paul Eisenstein from the DetroitBureau.com. This just breaking in the Associated Press. After days of speculation, U.S. and Afghan soldiers have launched that operation to tighten Taliban-controlled town of Marja in Helmand province. The initiative has actually begun. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
A lot of people, when they start their jobs, they get a great big employee handbook. John, did you read the employee handbook, the whole thing?
Oh, sure I did. Yes, every single word.
You probably didn't.
But
you may not know that there's a national organization, actually, for human resource workers. Did you know this? They actually conduct what's called a romance survey.
Hmm.
And in the last romance survey, 72% of employers say they do not have a written policy about dating in the office. 14% say they have an unspoken policy that everyone just kind of understands. And here's maybe an even more surprising fact. Most HR managers say marriage is the most common end result of workplace romances. And they even say that studies show a higher level of productivity from dating couples on the job. So every time we want to talk about work, we, of course, talk to Beth Kobliner, our work contributor. She's here to explain all of this and some of the difficulties, challenges, and maybe benefits of dating on the work.
We're also going to date our way out of this recession. Is that what you're saying, productivity-wise?
I doubt it, but it's an idea. We're also joined by a happily married couple who met at work, Shelley and Kevin Shanoy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Beth, let's look at this historically, because in the 1990s, we saw some kind of draconian policies. Dating at work was really frowned on.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you talk about, you know, when you match it up with the recession. It's the first time we've gotten some heartening news, and a Vault.com informal study just is coming out tomorrow that showed that when you look at the recession, 70% of people say that despite bad economic times, it hasn't affected their willingness to take a risk and plunge into love in the workplace. So I guess that's the heartening news, that despite bad times, people are still willing to take a risk. But you're right. You know, the last few years, we have seen a growing acceptance of work in love in the workplace. In fact, if you look at people today in their 20s, about 30% say they have had a romance in the workplace. Where if you look at people today in their 40s and you ask, have you ever had a romance in the workplace? Only 17% say they ever have had that. So I think there's a shifting, you know, acceptance of what's okay. And most polls these days say 40 to 60% say of people say, yes, I've had some sort of romantic relationship in my workplace. And 30% claim that that has led to some sort of partnership or marriage.
Okay, well, that's a lot of numbers, but yeah. We have in us the actual real result of these numbers. Shelley and Kevin,
all
you guys...
numbers.
That's right. You guys met on the job.
Yes.
And you're working for an international banking corporation. How did this kind of get started? Were you actually dating while you were working together?
No, I was dating someone else I was working with at the same job. And you were dating someone else, sort of.
Yeah, I think...
I've got to get into this international banking thing.
We also were working in a very old group, so we were like some of the only like young people that we had met. So it was kind of cool to meet someone of our age bracket.
True, but I was actually dating someone on my team, which was seriously frowned upon. So that was like this big secret.
But you and Kevin were in different departments.
But then we were sort of in the related departments, I guess. But we were openly flirting at work because I was already hiding a different relationship.
Well, was there a negative reaction if you were openly flirting where people notice it? There was.
I think for her, we were discussing this before, and for me, I got like a little, you know, my coworkers would give me
memo.
A time.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like a reality show.
Yeah. So it was kind of more acceptable for you to be flirting Kevin than for Shelley.
Yeah, I straight up got pulled aside and reprimanded.
And it's interesting because there was a study that came out last year that showed that it can be especially damaging for women. It's unfair but true. Women tend to be judged more harshly in these kind of situations. And it seems that, you know, when you – on the outward, it sounds like a great thing. You meet somebody in the workplace. But there are a lot of pitfalls that people have to be careful
of. How do you avoid them? What's the best way to handle this?
Well, first of all, the big no-no – and these guys did it and they seem to be okay – but dating somebody who is your boss or your, in this case, he wasn't your boss,
No. But
somebody who, if you're an employee, for example, the U.S. Army bans outright the idea of dating a superior.
Right.
UPS bans outright. If you're an employee, an hourly employee, you shouldn't be dating a supervisor.
Because of harassment cases.
Absolutely. But other workplaces, they have these love contracts or, you know, various rules. So you want to know your company's rules.
Then there's Letterman.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. And then you get into the situation of other workers being upset that, he's dating her and she's getting preferential treatment with the Letterman case. She's going on the air more. So are people upset that that person's getting... So they're all kind of state laws, federal laws, and workplace laws.
You should probably read your handbook, right?
Read that
handbook. Shelley and Kevin, what advice do you give to somebody who's met somebody on the job that they want to go out with, but they don't want to quit their job in order to date that person?
Be ready to keep a lot of secrets.
Be discreet.
you gotta be discreet. Don't be an idiot. I mean, don't flaunt anything. Don't make anything obvious. You've gotta try to hide it.
You're not saying don't be an idiot like I was. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I didn't want to say that.
That's the takeaway. Right. Don't be an idiot, which actually works on a lot of subjects
sweet.
On this
Have
show.
A happy Valentine's
Thank
Day,
you very
guys.
Shelley and Kevin Shenoy, a married couple. They met at work at an international banking firm. And, of course, Takeaway Work contributor Beth Koblenzer. Thanks so much.
You can learn more about Shelley and Kevin's intriguing romance on our website. We've got both versions of the story. You can check it out at thetakeaway.org. And do you have your own story of a workplace romance that went right or horribly wrong? We'd love to hear it in time for Valentine's Day, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or on our site, thetakeaway.org. And we want you to join the First Lady's Childhood Obesity Initiative, which she announced this morning. If you've lost weight, do you have a tip for the rest of us? What's the one thing you really can't give up?
My name is Jackie. I'm calling from Canton, Michigan, and I do a pretty good job of eating healthy, but my vice is Better Made barbecue potato chips.
Oh, my God. That's my vice, too. Yeah, Better Made. I feel you, Jackie.
We got a support group right here at The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
Put down the chips, Celeste.
I wish Hockenberry. I had some this Better Made potato chips.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.